Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight at 6 o'clock on 1A+, a conversation with the Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr. He talks to Jen White about the new national monument to his cousin and best friend, Emmett Till. They also talk about how best to teach Black history. That's at 6 o'clock on 1A+. Now on Central Time, let's talk about tipping point states and why they're so important in presidential elections. A tipping point state is mathematically indispensable to winning a presidential election. Wisconsin was one in 2016 and in 2020, and analysts expect that it will be once again in the upcoming election. We want to hear from you on this. You can call 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about tipping point states and the way that votes are counted? As a voter in a battleground state, do you feel like your vote is more important? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Craig Gilbert. Craig is the Lubar Fellow at Marquette University Law School and recently retired Washington Bureau Chief and National Political Reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's covered every presidential campaign since 1988. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
A tipping point state is not the same thing as a battleground state, right?
Well, it's you know, in all likelihood, a battleground state, but it's not necessarily the closest state in a given election. I mean, the way I would explain this is if you look at how Wisconsin voted in these last two presidential elections and you took all the states to the right of Wisconsin, they would not add up to an electoral majority of 270 electoral votes. And if you took all the states to the left of Wisconsin, they would not add up to an electoral majority of 270 votes. So both parties in a really close election absolutely needed Wisconsin to get an electoral majority. That's the tipping point state. It literally mathematically puts you over the top in the electoral college.
What about the level of importance? I mean, tipping point states are obviously crucial. Are they inherently more important than battleground states?
Yeah, I think it's really... Again, it's less a measure of the closest state than it is a measure of a state's strategic importance. It's really saying that if you have an election that's so close that it's decided by a single state, it turns out that's the state you needed under those circumstances. So it's probably the best. It's not the only battleground state because there are going to be other states, you know, that have results that are very close, for example, to Wisconsin in these last two elections. But the way things worked out in both of these elections, it was an indispensable state. So I think it's primarily a measure of a state's strategic importance when it comes to the Electoral College.
Help us understand the calculation of the tipping point state, because we have the Electoral College that actually elects a president, but the calculation involves looking at the popular vote.
No, it's really looking at, we're just talking about electoral votes now. Mm. So obviously every state, the electoral votes that state cast is decided by the popular vote in that state. But, you know, you have states that are very red and states that are very blue. And those electoral votes obviously go to the candidate that wins those states. But you also have a bunch of states in the middle. And so, in this case, the tipping point state is really kind of like the median state in the Electoral College. And it does mean in a close election, it's in all likelihood going to be very narrowly decided. Wisconsin was decided by less than a point in 2016 and in 2020. And of course, going back to 2000 and 2004 as well. And in those elections, it was not the tipping point state, but it was very close to being the tipping point state in 2004, in 1992, and it was also the tipping point state in 1976. So that tells you that Wisconsin's strategic importance in presidential elections spans, you know, a half a century.
How is it that we are keeping this position when it comes to electing presidents? What is different about Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting question because there's no one simple answer. I mean, if you pose that question about what makes a state a battleground state or what makes a state a purple state, You know, you think about it as a process of elimination. I mean, you've got a lot of states that are very red because of the regional political culture. I'm talking about the South and the Mountain West. You've got a lot of states that are very blue, again, for similar reasons. If you look at New England and you look at the West Coast, and then you have other states that, you know, all those states are off the table. They're not going to be battlegrounds. But what makes Wisconsin, I think, you know, one of a sh on a short list of states that currently is a battleground, I think, you know, has to do with the mix of voters, the fact that you've got urban voters, rural voters, and suburban voters. One of the big kind of, you know, variants in presidential voting is how white voters vote. And you have a tremendous disparity between how white voters in the Deep South vote, which is overwhelmingly Republican, and how white voters in a state like Vermont vote, which is overwhelmingly Democratic. And again, if you look at these Great Lakes states like Wisconsin, white voters tend to be more mixed in their voting, and it's a more competitive voting group. So that is part of the explanation. What's kind of more perplexing in some ways is how a state like Wisconsin has managed to remain so competitive over, you know, different political eras when voting patterns and demographic voting patterns have changed a lot.
Craig Gilbert is a former national political reporter. Now he's a fellow at Marquette University Law School. We are talking about Wisconsin as a tipping point state in this pivotal role in presidential elections. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. How do you think about Wisconsin's role in the national political spectrum when you hear about this? Is it surprising to you that it has been in this position for so long? Or maybe that's exactly what you've seen, that Wisconsin always winds up being a focus of attention in the over these decades. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll go ahead and go to Jeff in Superior now, who's giving us a call to talk about this. Hey, Jeff.
Well, hello. Good afternoon. I really appreciate the opportunity to express my opinion on this topic because Republican Party has chosen Milwaukee to be the venue for their convention next year, and I'm actually a member of the Douglas County GOP. But I don't think Wisconsin is the right venue for this type of presidential drama. With the indictments of Trump and all the conflict in the party, I think, in my opinion, that the GOP could have picked a better venue, and in fact, they may change the venue before the dates of the convention. The Democrats have chosen Chicago, and I think the Republicans would do better in Las Vegas or Arizona or somewhere where there's more enthusiasm and more, what I want to say, a majority of Republicans.
Thanks so much for that, Jeff. Craig, what do you think about Jeff's point when it comes to where these two major political parties are choosing to highlight their work and drum up support with their conventions?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question because parties have used, you know, have used different criteria to select their convention host cities. You know, stereotypically, we think of they're going to pick, you know, an absolute battleground. So, you know, if you can imagine getting a little bit of a benefit from having a convention in a state that you really, really need, you see that pattern a lot. But you also see examples of, and in fact, the Democrats chose Wisconsin, you know, for the convention 4 years ago that ended up happening in the pandemic. But we've also seen parties pick states for symbolic reasons, even states that they had no prayer of winning. I mean, the Republicans picked New York in 2004 because of the symbolism of New York post the 2001 attacks. Democrats picked L.A. In 2000. These are all conventions I covered when there was no way they were not going to win California. So there are logistical reasons, there are symbolic reasons, and then there is, you know, if you think you're going to get even a fractional benefit out of having a convention in a given place, that could be a reason, you know, for picking a given state. I mean, the caller mentioned Las Vegas. That is another battleground state, as is Arizona. And the Democrats in this case picked what is not a battleground state. It's in a battleground region, Illinois, but obviously Illinois is a safe Democratic state.
We're talking with former political reporter and now fellow Craig Gilbert about Wisconsin's status as a tipping point state, a status that we have held on to for a long time. We're also talking about what it might look like in the 2024 presidential election and Wisconsin's place in this political cycle. We want to hear what you think by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of Wisconsin's role in the Electoral College? Do you think it still makes sense? What do you want to say about our processes and our place in them? Call 800-642-1234, or you can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. This conversation continues ahead here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about Wisconsin's unique role in the last two presidential elections and the likely role it will play in 2024. We are a tipping point state. Our guest is Craig Gilbert from Marquette University Law School, and we're taking calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Jillian in Superior on the line. Hi, Jillian.
Hi. I'm just wondering, you mentioned that the demographic for Wisconsin voters has changed pretty significantly over the last, I'm not sure how many years you mentioned. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on that more and how that impacts upcoming presidential election.
Thank you so much for the call, Jillian. Yeah, I think, Craig, yeah.
Yeah, it's not so much that the demographics have changed, but the political demographics have changed, which in other words, the way different demographic groups vote has changed. And, you know, one huge example is rural voting patterns. And I think most people who follow politics understand that, you know, rural voters have become increasingly Republican in recent years. And Wisconsin was an example where Democrats were unusually competitive compared to other states with rural voters. Just as, you know, suburban voters have gotten less Republican and more Democratic, and Wisconsin was once a state where Republicans did unusually well, with particularly with suburban voters in southeastern Wisconsin on the periphery of Milwaukee. Both those things have changed. And so the political map within Wisconsin has changed. The sort of formula geographically to winning the state has changed. But these changes haven't fundamentally advantaged either party over the other party. In other words, Wisconsin has remained competitive despite all these changes. I would say one of the bigger demographic changes, which is relevant to the state's politics in the last 20 years, is the growth of Dane County and the growth of Madison, the growth of the city of Madison, and particularly the growth of the suburbs of Madison. Madison being as blue as it is, that has really been a boost to the Democratic Party, and it's helped the Democratic Party overcome what has been the shift in rural Wisconsin, particularly in northern and western Wisconsin, toward the Republican Party.
Craig, Lisa from Winter called, couldn't stay with us, but Lisa says she's thinking gerrymandering has caused Wisconsin to kind of appear purple, when in reality, Lisa thinks it's really blue. What's your assessment there?
Well, I mean, gerrymandering obviously doesn't affect statewide elections. Mm-hmm. It affects legislative elections and congressional elections. So, and it has certainly produced, you know, a Republican lock, a one-sided Republican lock on the state legislature. You know, but she also raises the question of whether Wisconsin overall is a blue state or a purple state. And, you know, over the long stretch of time where I've been covering politics, in which Wisconsin has basically fundamentally been a purple state, there have always been times when some people thought Wisconsin was on its way to becoming either a blue-leaning state or a red-leaning state. And it's always sort of come back to being a purple state. And I think, if you look at the last 7 or 8 years since Donald Trump came on the scene, I think Democrats are doing better in statewide elections than they had done in the previous period of time. And Republicans are struggling. But you have to be careful about kind of extrapolating that out to future elections, because I've learned to be very cautious about projecting Wisconsin's sort of future political direction. But again, I think it's hard to make the case that Wisconsin is a, quote, blue state when four out of the last six presidential elections have been decided by less than a percentage point, including the last two.
That is particularly interesting because, you know, you point to Wisconsin being a tipping point in 2016 and in 2020, and we elected very different presidents in those elections, and somehow Wisconsin stayed in that pivotal role.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we helped put Donald Trump over the top in 2016 and then helped put Joe Biden over the top in 2020. So we were one of a limited number of states that voted for both Trump and Biden. We're also one of a very short list of states that are electing U.S. senators from different parties. So by all of these markers, you know, I think you have to sort of land on purple as the color, the political color of Wisconsin right now.
How many states are really in a place where they could be a tipping point state? I mean, Wisconsin is here in the middle, but most states, right, are reliably Democratic or reliably Republican in the presidential election.
I think you would say at a minimum, probably of the 50 states, you know, 42 or 43 of them are kind of locked in. And again, I'm talking about in a theoretical close election, not a landslide election for one party or the other. But I think, you know, all but about seven or eight states are pretty much baked in. You could even argue that really, you know, there's only about four or five states that are truly in play. I mean, you've got Wisconsin. You've got, if you go again, use the 2020 election as a guide, you've got Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. And so I think those would be on your list going into 2024. And then, you know, you could throw in Nevada. You could throw in North Carolina. You could throw in Michigan, although that's become a little bit more comfortable for Democrats. Maybe New Hampshire, and that's about it. But again, it's a short list. It's kind of shocking, I think, particularly to political observers outside the U.S. that we have these, you know, massively costly and consequential presidential elections, and you're really talking about a battle over a handful of states.
You're making me feel a lot of pressure here as a Wisconsinite, Craig, thinking that all of this rests with just a few states.
It really does. And, you know, we're probably going to be one of them. And when the states that are tipping the Electoral College one way or another are themselves decided by a few thousand votes or even 10,000 votes or 20,000 votes, which is, you know, which is nothing, then, you know, you're really talking about a pivotal state in a pivotal election. I think, you know, there is nothing, you know, predetermined about the way Wisconsin is going to vote in 2024.
Mm-hmm. We've got Karen in Cable who wants to join the conversation. Karen, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm thinking about how gerrymandered Wisconsin is, and that may not make a difference for a presidential race, but it certainly does for Senate races and congressional races. When even if you overwhelmingly have a majority who are voting Democrat, we still can't get a Democratic representative. And, you know, the same can be said in terms of the Electoral College out west. They have much more power with such small populations than they currently have a right to. We really need to consider popular vote versus electoral votes.
Karen, thank you for the call. Absolutely. Just pointing out that the Electoral College is not like the Senate. You don't get a set number based on the fact that you're a state. It is based on population. But when she speaks, Craig, it makes me think about the fact that we have a couple of callers now who seem to think that maybe Wisconsin appears purple because of the elected leaders we have in more local elections that are lots of Republicans, and then going Democratic in other ways. Is that anything that we can try to quantify?
Yeah, again, I think the only way to really evaluate, you know, the statewide partisan makeup of a state is to look at the biggest statewide elections. And we've talked about presidential races and how close they've been. We've talked about the fact that Wisconsin has alternately elected Democratic and Republican senators. It's one of, you know, very few states. I think we're down to maybe five or six that have one Democrat and one Republican serving in the U.S. Senate. And if you look at governor's races, we had, you know, Scott Walker winning. Well, if you want to go back in time, we had Tommy Thompson winning four races for governor in a row. We had, again, a Republican. We had Democrat Jim Doyle winning the next two races for governor after that. We had Republican Scott Walker winning the next three races after that, if you include the recall election. And now we've had Democrat Tony Evers winning the two races after that. So again, I'm going to sort of stand by my assessment that we're about as purple as you can get as a state. I would add on the question of the Electoral College, the caller does have a point in the sense that because every state's electoral votes are based mostly on population, but also every state is added to electoral votes for their senators, that does give small states a little bit of an extra voice in the Electoral College. On the other hand, while there are a lot of Republican small states, there are also some Democratic small states. So I think right now there is a Republican advantage structurally in the Electoral College, but that has just emerged in the last two elections. And that doesn't necessarily mean that in the next two elections, there's going to be the same Republican built-in advantage in the Electoral College.
Yes or no, Craig, is Wisconsin a tipping point in 2024?
Oh, yes. Well, there's only going to be one tipping point state. So whether it's Wisconsin or Arizona or Georgia or Pennsylvania could be just a matter of a fraction of a vote, but it's absolutely going to be one of the short number of states that matters and that will be bombarded by both campaigns.
We got a shot. Craig, thank you so much for joining us. Craig Gilbert talking about Wisconsin's position as a tipping point. This is Central Time. And coming up tomorrow here on the show, we saw that just one day after Wisconsin State Supreme Court swore in a new and importantly liberal justice, redistricting advocates are suing. They want the high court to force Wisconsin to redraw voting maps that give Republicans the upper hand in state elections. We break down what's going on and whether they have a shot tomorrow here on Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for being with us here on the Ideas Network. A major freight carrier shut down earlier this week, leaving more than 30,000 workers without jobs. Coming up, a former long-haul truck driver gives us an inside look into the massive, yet often invisible, world of trucking. First, staffing shortages are an issue every day in senior living facilities in Wisconsin. And according to Wisconsin Watch, conditions at some have become neglectful and even dangerous. And that is one of the many reasons our guest says aging now is more difficult than it needs to be. We want to hear from you as we think about aging. You can call 800-642-1234. Share the challenges you've faced as you've been getting older, or perhaps your quality of life has improved. Let's talk about what it means to age in our society now, because we're also talking about our failure to support our elders and the people who care for them. We'll look at how we might improve the system and how we can also embrace the many joys of aging with our guest, Marie-Therese Connolly. She's a leading national expert on elder justice, and she wrote the new book called The Measure of Our Age, Navigating Care, Safety, Money, and Meaning Later in Life. MT, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Keely.
Your book opens up in northern Wisconsin. It's a story about your mother-in-law's birthday. Tell us about that. How does it relate to the central theme of your book?
Well, thanks for that. Yeah, I grew up in Minnesota, but we had a cabin in northern Wisconsin, and we were taking a canoe and kayak ride on the Brule River, on the Brule from, you know, that empties out into Lake Superior, on my mother-in-law's 88th birthday. And she was this really extraordinary human being. Her name was Janet. And we were stopping by a little island in the river, and my kids leaned over and picked some flowers and gave her a little wildflower crown. And we all sang happy birthday. And then she made a funny face. And we said, "So, you know, why are you making the funny face?" And she said, "Well, for a second, I thought you were going to leave me on this little island. I know it sounds crazy, but for a minute, I thought it was true. And so I was really struck by that moment, because in this like very loving time and day where she was having fun and we were all having fun and we were together in the, you know, the natural beauty of Northern Wisconsin, she suddenly was worried. And so that made me sort of think about aging and how some older people really worry about being abandoned in their lives. So that, and it seemed like a good place to open the book, because there are a lot of challenges in aging, and there's also a lot to look forward to and a lot of beauties. And we sometimes miss out. We sometimes are unprepared and underestimate both of those.
I imagine you did nothing to make her think that you would just leave her there. And yet it really surfaced a real fear when it comes to isolation or being left behind. What role do you see that playing when we think about aging?
Well, as your question implies, isolation and loneliness are a huge epidemic among older people these days, and it's really very damaging for older people. You know, people 85 and older are the fastest growing part of population of the U.S. In the U.S. right now, and that is really amazing and wonderful. We get to live longer lives and we have more time on the planet. But our lifespans are often longer than our health spans. So the average life expectancy is about 78. The average healthy life expectancy is about 66 years. And so a lot of older adults have some kind of functional disability. That means that a lot of people are going to need care. And we don't really have very good care systems in place right now. You know, Medicare doesn't cover long-term care. Most private health plans don't cover long-term care. And so a lot of families are really very much on their own, which is one of the reasons that we have more than 40 million informal or unpaid caregivers in the United States right now who don't get much help.
Needing care, being in those sort of senior living facilities can physically isolate you. It can also emotionally isolate you from people. And then we have the added layer that you just touched on, the chronic staffing issues, the difficulty with finding reliable workers and being able to pay them well. Certainly that's an issue here in Wisconsin. Is that an issue everywhere?
It's an issue in many, many places. Direct care worker shortages, both in facilities as well as in homes. And it's, I think there are probably many different reasons to point to, but historically we have not treated direct care workers very well, and we haven't paid them well. We haven't provided paths for advancement, for good supervision, for helping care workers feel like we value the care they're providing and that we value the people for whom they provide care. So I think part of it is that, and we could do a lot better at that.
Are there tangible things that you could offer in this conversation to do a lot better? Or is this really something that we need to look at more, that we need to collaborate on more to figure out how we're going to fix that?
Well, I think it's both things. I think there's a lot more we can do, and we do need to collaborate more to find better solutions too, because aging is, I've come to think of it as aging is not just an aging problem. Aging is an issue for all generations, and our policy failures cascade into all the generations. And so we really need to start getting ahead of that. So some of the things that we can do is to provide better caregiver support so that caregivers who are providing care for loved ones at home don't feel so alone. So they feel like they have resources or respite or education. You know, for example, dementia is a really complicated illness to care for. And we just expect that people somehow know how to do that. And a lot of people don't. And so we really need to support caregivers better. We also need to do better in terms of our stewardship over public funds. So, for example, nursing homes and what are called CCRCs, or continuing care retirement communities, they get over $100 billion a year in taxpayer dollars. And yet we don't know how they're spending those dollars and how many of those dollars actually go to caring for residents and to the benefit of residents. And sometimes we don't even know who owns the facilities who are getting those dollars. So I think just exercising better stewardship and requiring better accountability as a condition for getting those funds would go a long way, because we're already pouring billions and billions of dollars into our long-term care system. We just need to make sure that we spend those dollars well. And one other thing, as you alluded to, is that we know that staffing is the most important element of quality care, whether it's at home or in facilities. And so we need to make sure that we have adequate staff.
We're talking with Elder Justice Advocate M.T. Connolly about how aging is hard and how we can make it even harder to handle with the systems that we've put in place or that we haven't. And we're welcoming your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. We're wondering what your life is like right now. Have you had to put in place some opportunities to make sure that you are aging well? Maybe you're at an earlier stage of your life and you're looking ahead and starting to think about that already because you know that that's inevitable as bodies grow older. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can join in that way and help us better understand how you're living well into the later years. MT, there are certainly individual challenges that we deal with when we're aging, and yet we have this broader culture that does influence the way we think about aging and death and value. How do you see our broader culture affecting the way we treat people who are getting older?
It's such a great question, Keely. So we live in a country that is really scared of aging, that is really anti-aging. We hear a lot more about anti-aging than we do about aging well. And I think we need to create a more pro-aging culture. And that's not a victimless crime in a sense. We know from other kinds of bias that bias leads to dehumanizing the people against whom we feel bias. And we then, it's sort of like a toxin that then seeps into our institutions and into ourselves. And yet we feel like it's okay to feel ageism because we're all just getting older. And so we kind of don't notice what the damage is, although a researcher at Yale did a study showing that people who held the most positive views of aging lived 7.5 years longer than people who held the most negative views. So I think one of the challenges is to really take on how we think about aging, and try and get rid of the fear and the denial and the shame, because they don't do us any good. It's just useless negative feelings. And to really kind of turn that dial to more positive feelings about aging, because there's also really good evidence of health benefits if we can embrace a sense of purpose as we grow older, and of meaning and of feeling connection and staying connected to the people that we care about.
We're talking with author M.T. Connolly about her new book about figuring out care and finances and purpose as we age. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What have you enjoyed about getting older? What's been difficult? What didn't you expect? Do you feel like people treat you differently? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Join our conversation now here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about the systems we have in place to support us as we age and whether they work or actually make the journey more difficult than it should be. Our guest is M.T. Connolly, who's written a book about this. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. M.T., to kind of pick up where you left off, I know in talking with people aging in my family, I've heard them say, well, I don't want to be a burden. And I'll say that's such a hard thing to hear because we value them so much, but it has to be much, much harder to feel like that.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, so often people feel like they're either failing at aging or failing at caring. And a lot of that actually goes back to our broken systems. If we had a more robust network of community supports and services, that then older people wouldn't feel as worried about being a burden on their families because they would feel like there was support out there for them and for their family, their caregiving family members. So I think that is, it's like a warning sign or a, you know, some kind of smoke that suggests that we look more closely at how we're supporting people and families through aging. Mm-hmm.
We have Carol in New Richmond who's ready to join our conversation. Hey, Carol.
Hi there.
Hi. What did you want us to hear from you today?
Well, from a nursing point of view, I've been a nurse for almost 43 years now, and I teach the CNA program, and many of the CNAs that I do teach are, and hopefully they're listening, you know, I think that it's just, first of all, it's such a great, whether you work in home care or in a facility, there's so many opportunities, and it's extremely rewarding career. And many of them do work with the elderly. Right now, the WIS Caregiver Program does offer free education, and it's, you know, it's a great deal. It's a great deal for facilities as well because they also get some finances when somebody signs up through them. So, you know, and I do, you know, your speaker is so interesting because there is a lot of services that are lacking, I think, as a community. There's so many things that we can do. And, you know, the more active that seniors can be, the longer they are able to take care of themselves. And that's the basis of our whole education that I teach, is to keep them as active and as independent as they can for as long as they can do things for themselves.
Carol, thank you so much for sharing that with us and also for all of the work that you've done over these years as a nurse. I just want to make sure you understand that we appreciate you. MT, that brings us to a point about joy. I heard Carol talk about people being able to live independently, to do things on their own. What do you see people enjoying or looking forward to enjoying later in life?
Well, you know, first, I want to thank you too, Carol, for your 43 years of work and also for training the next generation of CNAs. It's incredibly important, and Wisconsin is fortunate to have you. In terms of joy, I have a colleague and friend named Ann Bastien, who teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, who started an organization called Time Slips that's really in the business of joy. And Ann pervades a technique called creative engagement, whether it's for older people who are living in facilities or at home, and really trying to evoke more joy from life. So, for example, one of the things that I wrote about in my book is a program or something that Anne created called Beautiful Questions, where there are questions that have no right or wrong answers. And my niece, Charlotte, actually went into a nursing home. She was volunteering at a nursing home and used these questions to start conversations about creativity. Like, how does music make you feel? Or what is a place that calms you? And so that, you know, it doesn't rely so much on memory. So that for people who have memory issues, they can still participate in these conversations, and it's a really profound technique. Actually, the doctor I wrote about, a woman named Laura Mosqueda, and I went on a road trip to Morgantown, Kentucky, to see a play that Anne produced in a nursing home, a play called Wendy's Neverland, based on the Peter Pan story, but in Anne's version of it, Wendy has grown up and grown old and is living in a nursing home. And the residents and the staff and artists were all the actors and the crew. And it was this expression of joy and generosity and beauty. And it was really a very moving thing to see. So I think one thing we do too often is to give up on old age as a time that we kind of ignore at best or fear. And we should embrace it as a time of potential expanded opportunity for creativity and storytelling, and really think about what matters most to us on our own and with the people we love in our later years.
Thank you for that. We've had Ann Basting on Central Time before, and so we've linked our conversation with Ann on our website at WPR.org. So thank you for mentioning this work that's happening really close to home here for WPR. We're talking with M.T. Connolly about how aging is hard and how our systems can make that better or actually more challenging. She's an elder justice advocate. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. I wonder, MT, lots of people have lots of advice about aging, but what did you want to share that's a different take than what's already in front of us?
It's kind of a simple recipe, I think, but one that we too often miss, which is to really think about it, to be intentional about aging, and then to have the conversations, to think about what are going to be the challenges, whether it relates to care or money or really complicated balancing of autonomy and safety issues, and then how do we plan for it to be a time of life where we do things that matter to us, to have purposeful activity. And a lot of people find a lot of purpose in volunteering or in doing something that they've never done before. And then to make sure also that we have the conversations in our families, among friends, and then also to push policymakers and employers and other institutions to be having the conversations about aging. How do we make sure that we're preparing for the challenges and that we can take advantage of and don't miss out on the really good parts of it? Because there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, and I think there are small things that we can do to really improve our odds of a better old age.
I want to talk briefly about elder justice because you've done a lot of work in this area. And I think it's important when you talk about policymakers to help us understand how that form of social justice intersects with other areas like race or gender or sexuality. Put elder justice in some context for us.
Absolutely. It's a question with many parts, but I'll try and do it quickly. What we know is that other forms of injustice make aging harder. So, for example, people of color experience about twice as much elder financial exploitation. And low-income Latinos were victimized about four times as often in terms of all kinds of elder abuse. And so what we see is a compounding of inequities over the lifespan. And often the people who most need access to care have the least capacity to pay for it because we don't really have a payer system. We don't have a long-term care insurance system per se, except for Medicaid. And so we really need to do much better at that and start having those kinds of conversations as well. Now, having privilege or resources is not a silver bullet. It doesn't protect you from some of the challenges of aging, but it is certainly much more, there are many more challenges for people of color and for people without resources.
It's certainly very complicated and so many things connected. MT, thank you so much for joining us today and for writing this book.
I really appreciate your having me, and thanks for the conversation, Keely.
Marie-Therese Connolly is a nationally recognized expert on elder justice, and we talked with MT about her new book. It's called The Measure of Our Age, Navigating Care, Safety, Money, and Meaning Later in Life. Coming after the news, the Yellow Trucking Company shut down earlier this week, and that's reinvigorating a conversation about the industry. We've got a labor organizer and former long-haul trucker joining us ahead. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.